Good day to you, sirs and madams. This is a special episode of the podcast because it's me being interviewed. Last week, I was asked to go on to Dublin City FM to talk about me and my business. And we talked about charity sector and innovation and fundraising and chuggers and all of these things. And so you can hear some of my opinions, some of my background, and just general radio waffle. I'd love to hear what you think, but if you have no interest in me, then feel free to skip, and I will be back interviewing someone really interesting next week, and we'll be back to normal then. Enjoy.
Afternoon, and welcome to You and Your Business with me, Alec Drew, on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Each week, we have an expert from the world of business sharing their knowledge, insights and tips to help you reduce costs, increase profits and drive efficiencies. If there's a topic that you would like covered or if you feel that you can make a contribution, please email me at yourbusiness@dublincityfm.ie and perhaps we'll be chatting here one day soon. My guest is an international trainer and speaker on all things fundraising, helping charities and events secure more funding. He went from a crippling fear of public speaking to becoming the UK and Ireland's public speaking champion of Toastmasters. He speaks about mental health and work-life balance. I'm delighted to welcome to the You and Your Business studio, Simon Scriver. Good afternoon, Simon.
Good afternoon, Alec. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, delighted to have you here. I know you're living quite locally here, but I'm not hearing a local accent there, Simon. Would you like to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I have maybe a bit of a colonial English accent. I grew up in Hong Kong, and so although I'm Irish, I'm kind of stuck with this peculiar voice.
Well, it's not peculiar. That's it. No, it's quite into Hong Kong. That's an interesting place. It was. I know you're not that old, but was that while it was still under the reign of the British and...
Yeah. So I moved out there for my dad's job long before it was handed back to the Chinese. And I did almost all of my school out there. And then we left just before 97. So 97 was when the British handed it back to the Chinese.
Oh, fantastic. That must have been a very interesting experience as a child growing up there. I mean, that would have taken you probably nearly towards the end of your schooling.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it. It was great. It was very hard to leave. I mean, we used to come back to Ireland every summer. And so I still had the connection to the Irish roots there. But I loved Hong Kong. I loved being in an international school with, you know, a huge mix of people from all over the world. And we had a pretty good life out there.
Well, I'd say you did. A very eclectic mix. You must have learned a lot from being out there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much I've learned beyond the school stuff or even in school. But I feel pretty fortunate that I went to school with a lot of English, American, Chinese, Indian people. So I feel like it maybe exposed me to a lot of the world that perhaps I wouldn't have got if I had have grown up elsewhere. And I'm still in touch with a lot of people, so I know when I go around the world, when I travel, usually I can look up in that city and find someone that I went to school with, and I'm grateful for that.
Well, particularly with the career you've got now, it must be good to have international connections.
It's good. It helps maybe accommodation costs and things like that. Or you get the local person to show you around a bit. But yeah, it's good.
Excellent stuff. So as I understand, you came back to the UK for a short while then.
Yeah, so I finished school in the UK. I did A-levels in the UK, the British system. And then I came back to Ireland to go to university, to go to DCU.
All right. How did you find DCU?
Mixed feelings. I studied maths there, and while there's good things about college life, I mean, I have to say I much prefer the working life. I much prefer being out of education now.
There you go. I think that would probably contradict a lot of those who have discovered what working life is really like. Yeah. And they have to pay their own way.
Yeah.
No, that's it. So, okay, from DCU, what did you do then?
So after college, I had this notion that I would, I suppose, be an accountant. I worked in finance, and I kind of moved between finance and sales. So I was working in finance and accountancy for like pharmaceutical firms, for banks, for different terrible businesses that I just, had trouble sleeping at night working for them. And then I would work in sales, selling things that I really hated and really didn't want to sell. And so it was a pretty miserable career of an existence is working for people that you didn't like. And so I guess I knew something needed to change at that point.
I tell you, you're very lucky you weren't born 100 years earlier. You wouldn't have had an opportunity to change anything.
Yeah, I'd have been up the chimneys.
And staying there. Fascinating. And I think that probably resonates with so many people, that they find themselves getting involved in a career, let's say accountancy or something like that. But for them, it's not the world, but it's a safe pensionable job, and that's always the challenge. How do you break free from that?
Yeah, I mean, it's like some of my friends are in safe pensionable jobs, and they might not like them, but that's okay for them. You know, they don't. That's not their life. They have a lot of life outside of work. They clock off at 5 o'clock and they go home, and it's about family and hobbies and things like that. But for me, I wanted to love my work. And so I moved around a lot in terms of jobs. I mean, I think I had maybe 40, 50 jobs before I fell into the area of work which I really liked. And I'd stumbled into that. I stumbled into fundraising. I stumbled into working in the not-for-profit sector.
Well, that's an interesting one to get involved, because you were doing some sales and telemarketing. Mm-hmm. So obviously you were picking up the skills. So Matt's in school, then on to accountancy, and now then into sales and telemarketing. So obviously you're picking up the core skills and now going to blend them into something that made sense for you.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, almost any job is a mixture between sales and administration. I think like almost every job is either sales or administration or a mix of that. And so I think finance and sales served me well. They gave me the skills. You know, I'm not an outgoing person. I'm not good at, or I wasn't good at talking to people. I have a lot of social anxiety. And so I was able to, you know, try and use those skills to develop my career a bit.
Yeah, and you also, you were telling me you discovered some of this love of fundraising when you were backpacking in Oz.
Yeah, so when I was trying to escape from these jobs, I went backpacking for 3 years. So I went backpacking around the world for 3 years. I did a few jobs here and there along the way to pay the bills. But that's where I got my first fundraising job, was during these 3 years of milling around the world. I got a fundraising job in Australia.
Wow. Can you talk about that in any way? Or?
Yeah, I mean, the job was those guys who stand on the street fundraisers who stop people and try and sign them up for charity. And, you know, a lot of people have very strong opinions on those people. I have a lot of love for them, you know, because that job changed my life. I can see why some people object to them, but they do good work. They earn very little and they raise a lot of money. And I learned a lot of skills there. Again, I'm talking to strangers on the street, which is completely out of my comfort zone. And I'm selling charity. I'm selling something intangible. And so for me, it was one of the hardest, worst jobs I've ever done. But it was one of the best, most life-changing jobs because of the skills it gave me, because of the opportunities it opened up, because of the course it set my life on.
It's amazing where we find self-fulfillment in the strangest of places, standing on street corners in Melbourne doing two things you probably hate. But
yeah, I mean, it's not what I dreamed about when I was a little kid. But it was good for you. You know, I think everyone can do well to have a bit of sales experience. You know, you might hate it, but you know, we're always selling ourselves. We're always selling our business. In every area of your life, there's an element of sales. And so if you have a few of those skills to talk to people and to sell, you can make a success of it.
It just shows you, I think, the lesson learned out of that is sometimes you have to be taken out of your comfort zone just to experience life. And that may lead you to a path to true fulfillment.
Absolutely. I mean, I met a guy who became a good friend of mine when I was backpacking, and he had this phrase he said to me, which was, you have to put yourself out there so good things can happen. And, you know, he said that to me, God, you know, 20 years ago, and nearly 20 years ago, and that was life-changing for me. Put yourself out there so good things can happen. And it's true. People don't knock on your door and offer you opportunity. People don't buy your thing unless you talk to them. But the more you put yourself out there, the more amazing people you meet, the more opportunities you get, and the more successful you become. And that's become a mantra in business and in my personal life, is it's not comfortable, but if I put myself out there, good things happen to me.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, so we're just on the street corners of Melbourne, finding ourselves. What next?
Well, then I came back. I travelled back through. I was still travelling, and I think I had kind of assumed I would always travel. My dad got sick, so my dad got very sick at the time, and so I ended up kind of, I suppose, being a bit tied to that. I ended up back in Dublin and settled down there because I met someone and had a son, a beautiful son, whose birthday is this week. And I continued my fundraising career here. I found a fundraising agency, and I just said, I want to work for you. And they hired me into their offices. And that continued my fundraising career, trying to learn the skills, trying to build my experience and meet more people and work up the ladder of fundraising.
Right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to me, Alec Drew, on 103.2 Dublin City FM, where my studio guest is Simon Scriver, sharing his knowledge on all things fundraising for charity and events. What's the website, Simon, just for our listeners?
So my website, changefundraising.com.
Changefundraising.com. Fantastic. So in terms of getting involved in that charity, was there any particular area of charity that...
Yeah, so it was an agency that worked with a lot of different charities, and that's kind of where my career has stayed, although I've worked in-house for a couple of non-profits. Mainly I've stayed on the agency side where charities come to us, and now as a self-employed person, as an individual, people come to me and people came to the agency to get help with fundraising. So either to do areas of fundraising for them or to learn how to be a better fundraiser. Because what you have to realize is charities are founded by people who care very passionately about a cause. They want to make the world better. They want to have an impact on something that's personally affected them. They don't care about sales. They don't care about marketing. Right. They don't care about fundraising. That stuff gets in the way. And I suppose where my role has been in my career is to pick up a bit of the slack of that and show them that fundraising isn't a terribly scary thing. It can actually be quite simple and quite easy. And take these people who care very passionately about cause and teach them how to sell it.
Yeah. I think people tend to forget that fundraising is a business. Mm. And it's not a kind of highly profitable business in the sense of people taking a lot of money out of the organization, but it requires all of the skills that any other business needs.
Absolutely. And we have a very, I suppose, uncomfortable relationship with nonprofits because we expect them to be professional. We expect them to, you know, spend money on good governance, to be accountable for all of their money. And at the same time, we have, on the flip side of it, we have this notion that charities, there shouldn't be, no one should be earning a wage in it, and no one should be a business person in it. And so we have to get that right. I mean, everyone I work with, all my clients, they care very passionately about the work they do, but at the same time, they need to present that work in a professional manner and communicate with people, treat their donors, treat their supporters professionally so that they continue to fund their work.
You're right. You've sort of identified it there. It is a strange thing in business. If you were to take that into sort of the retail, you know, environment, I'm buying a chair. Why should I be worried about what profit you're making on the chair? Mm. You know, but I do understand you have to put it in a shop. You have to pay for the shop. You have to pay for all the ancillaries and staff and that around it. Mm-hmm. Charities are no different. They have to do all of the business things.
Absolutely. They're competing with, they're competing for your money with alcohol companies and with shops and holidays, you know, so they need to attract people the way they do. I remember a few years ago, there was a big, you know, people questioning why Oxfam had a shop on Grafton Street and how they could afford it. But no one was questioning why Brown Thomas had a shop there.
Yes.
You know, they have a shop because there's a lot of footfall, because they can bring in a lot of money and they can, make profit where that profit actually goes to help some of the most needing people in the world.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thought around that. We do see these charity shops around. I mean, without being overly critical or picking any side, mm-hmm. my experience has been they seem to be run by volunteers, mm-hmm. where they could be a lot more professional. Is that a challenge that a lot of them
No, play? I mean, I think volunteers have a lot to offer, and I think they're a great resource that non-profits have that maybe businesses don't, although businesses get in unpaid interns sometimes. But they have that resource of volunteers. But those volunteers, they still need to be motivated. They still need to be trained to do their job well. So, you know, if they don't have the right persona or the right interaction in a shop, it can lose money. You know, it can be the difference between you buying something and not buying something is how you're treated in the shop, just like any other shop in the world, whether it's a charity or not.
And I think that is a gap that could be plugged in terms of my experience of charity shops. There are people with the best will in the world, the nicest people, but you can see they have not been trained in the art of selling. And
yeah, and I think that's in every area of fundraising, and that's a lot of the work I do. You know, if you call up a charity, if you email a charity, if you write to them, what's the experience that you're getting there? And are you being neglected? Is your email being ignored? Are you getting the right answers back? Are you being treated well when you walk into a shop? And so a lot of it is just not necessarily professionalizing it, but giving them the tools to treat their supporters well. In the same way that a shop trains its staff to look after its customers, a non-profit needs to do the same thing to look after its supporters.
Yeah, certainly the modern business world, we've become less tolerant of poor service and of things that don't meet our expectations. Mm-hmm. And yet, we on the other side of it, we're nearly giving out that money might be spent to match our expectations by having professional people just because it's in the charitable sector.
Yeah, it is strangely contradictory, and I know a lot of the charity sector gets frustrated with it. You know, the expectations that are put on them of how they should be run and how professional they should be run, and yet those same people have the expectations that you should only have volunteers, and that you shouldn't pay people, and that you shouldn't invest in marketing or fundraising. I mean, companies invest in marketing because it works. It brings in more customers. So, you know, charities follow the same principle. If you invest in marketing and fundraising, you bring in more money, which helps you help more people.
Yes, and I mean, there's a lot of people in that space fighting for your money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, people talk about, are there too many charities? And I don't necessarily think there are, because there's a lot of work to be done. Yes, maybe there's some overlap, and we've seen a lot of charity mergers in the last few years, which is great. But we are competing for a limited amount of money. You know, there is money out there, but you know yourself, you choose to buy some ridiculous stuff on the internet, or you choose to go out and you choose to go on a holiday and upgrade your hotel room, or do you choose to pump money back into your community to help, you know, some of the most vulnerable, or help, you know, implement some of these services? And it's difficult. And until we kind of figure out taxation and how to actually, you know, redistribute the wealth a bit better, charities have that role to try and pick up the slack.
It must be a challenge in the sort of modern world now that people are not carrying cash with them, so you're sort of bucket shakers out on the street, mm-hmm. which it seems to rile a lot of people. But yeah. How is that affecting, I mean, how people are transacting their business?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously digital and online fundraising has made a big change and shifted the way people give. But sometimes it's kind of surprising. I mean, the statistics for how much money is being donated online, at the moment it's only 7%. 7% of the nonprofit sector comes in online, and the rest of that is still offline. So people are still donating by checks and cash, and maybe we're not quite as advanced as we think. But at the same time, yeah, we have to adapt with the times. We have to have those buckets that accept contactless payments. Mm-hmm. We have to be able to work with wherever our potential donors are. And so we have to adapt. And again, that's something that takes investment to adapt. So, you know, if we're not willing, you know, if a donor is not willing to fund a charity buying these contactless buckets because it seems like a waste of money, then we're never going to evolve and we're never going to adapt. So sometimes non-profits are caught in this innovation hole where we can't innovate, we can't evolve because no one's willing to pay for it. Yeah, you know, we want our money to go directly to the cause. We don't want to be wasting money on innovation, and then that sort of overtakes the charity, and they can't evolve.
I suppose this is about being more agile then as a charity, and possibly finding a sponsor who would provide that sort of technology for them.
Yeah, well, you see a few of the tech companies coming in and trying to support that because they have the expertise and they have the knowledge to do that. But at the same time, you know, unfortunately, tech companies and a lot of companies are not very generous at all and not very supportive of it.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they like to be loud about it and they like to tell you they're giving away a lot. But, if, you know, you look at some of the profits in multinationals, you know, especially in Ireland, who for some reason, they have set up their offices here for whatever reason. When you compare what they're putting back into the community versus the profit they're making, sometimes it's a bit disappointing. But at the same time, there are good people, you know, and you see the Bill Gates of the world who are pumping a lot of money back into the nonprofit sector to develop these things. And it'll come. It's just it's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of change to be made.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into the whole taxation system here.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. I can just see this field with a big sign in it saying landmines. So I think we'll stay out of that one for the time being. In terms of You mentioned also the real challenge for most of these organizations is telling their story.
Mm-hmm.
And you help them with that.
Yeah, I mean, nonprofits are not always very good at sharing the stories that motivate people to want to give. So nonprofits and charities, very often they have a tendency to talk about themselves. You know, they'll tell you who founded them. They'll tell you what year they were founded. They'll tell you, you know, how they work. And what we find is that that's not really what motivates donors to give. Donors want to give as directly to the cause as they can. And so good nonprofit fundraising is for the charity to almost become invisible. You know, and I always talk about fundraisers as being a bridge between the donor and the beneficiary or the service user, whoever benefits from the charity. And so what you're trying to do is build that bridge and make yourself a little bit invisible. A really good example of that is you know, if you sponsor a child, if you've ever sponsored a child through one of these charities, you get a letter from the child, you get a drawing from the child, you get a photo of the child, and that connects you to where your money's going as well as can be done. So a lot of the work I do is finding, okay, how do we do that? How do we present video, imagery, you know, how do we introduce the donors and potential donors to these beneficiaries? How do we remove you from the equation? I mean, you the charity still needs to exist because they're the ones with the professional people implementing these services, but the donor needs to see what the impact is. The donor needs to see what's going to get better because of their money.
Yeah, and you're dead right there. I was just thinking as you were talking about, and not kind of associate children with what I'm about to say, but one of the most sort of professional organisations I've ever come across is Dogs Trust.
Mm.
And the number of people who really give to that organisation, mm-hmm. but not just in terms of money, but how they take animals out and mm-hmm. adopt them and all sorts of things.
They're an amazing charity. I used to do some work with them. And you know, they have a venue. You can go in. You can see the dogs, you know, whatever, they're pumping classical music and heated floors to their dogs or whatever they do. They've got a beautiful venue there. Anyone listening can go out and check it out, and you know where your money's going. Your money is going to help that cute little dog that's sitting in front of you. Now, a lot of organizations, they don't have that. You know, if you're a nonprofit who's working with survivors of sexual abuse, or if you're working in overseas aid, there isn't a venue for your supporters to come in and see. So how can you as a nonprofit create that? How can you bring them as close as possible?
That's actually a very, very good question to ask, and that's where you bridge the gap. That's quite interesting. Just if you're just joining us now, you're listening to me, Alec Drew, on 103.2 Dublin City FM, where my studio guest is Simon Scriver, sharing his knowledge on all things fundraising for charities and events. And the website again, Simon, is
changefundraising.com.
You also raise money for events. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, so part of it as well is events, people setting up street events, people doing, you know, touristy events around the country, around Ireland and in other countries. And again, these are people who've set it up because they're either passionate about their local area, they're passionate about a certain feature of the country, passionate about a particular musician. And then they suddenly realize, well, we need money to run this event. And so they're not experts in bringing in sponsorship from companies, and I suppose again that's where I come in, is helping them present their case to a company of why a company should hand over money to them so that they can run these events.
That's quite an interesting. So I mean, what you've really identified here is that there's a niche market. There's a niche market for your particular skill set.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah, well, you have. Although you tend to operate on your own. You like that space.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, my career has evolved over time, and I suppose a few years ago or several years ago, I started making moves towards working completely independently. I guess I had enough of working in offices and working with staff and managing staff. And so a couple of years ago, I went out on my own. So I'm an independent consultant, but people hire me. And so I'll go in for, a couple of days, or I'll go in for a day a month, or I'll go and speak at a conference and help these organizations do what they do. I mean, I love my job, and it seems to be working. People hire me, people pay me to come travel around the world and speak to them and teach them how to fundraise. I suppose job-wise, I'm happier than I've ever been.
Fantastic. Well, you're doing something that we should all be aspiring to do. Well, I'm lucky I do it as well, but find something you love doing and monetize it in some way, and you know, to have the life that you want. We don't all have to be on yachts and doing things. We just all we want is a nice life. You're talking about traveling the world and speaking. Mm-hmm. I get back to my intro where you were sort of this morbid fear of speaking to people, and now you're thrown up on stage and you have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I like that morbid fear. Yeah. I used to really hate public speaking, as I think most people in the world do. And I realized, you know, going back to what I said before, you have to put yourself out there so good things can happen. I could see that in business, that the people who were most successful weren't necessarily the smartest, or weren't necessarily the best, but they were the loudest, and the people who were willing to stand up in front of a room and speak. And so I ended up joining going to an organization called Toastmasters, who I believe you're familiar with.
I am indeed, yeah.
And they help you speak better. And so I put a lot of time and a lot of work into trying to overcome my fear of public speaking. I still have a fear of public speaking. I still, you know, have that social anxiety and feel very insecure in myself. But I started speaking more and more in front of groups, and it started working for me. And I started getting invited to speak in more places, started getting paid more to speak. And then I entered this Toastmasters competition that they run worldwide every year, where you deliver a speech, and you can see this speech on my website. But you deliver a speech and you go through these series of rounds in a competition. And I got through to the last 90 in the world, where I competed in Washington, D.C., delivering my speech.
Well done. Well done. As a person who comes from the world of professional speaking, all I can say, one piece of advice, and to anybody else out there, is if you're not fearful of getting up on stage, give it up, because it means you don't care anymore.
Yeah.
But listen, you've done a fantastic job. And I suppose, really, I can't believe that clock has just moved on so quickly there. What a great interview. I just totally love that. So, okay, that's all we've time for today. A special thanks to our guest, Simon Scriber, for coming into the You and Your Business studio today. If you want to know more about Simon, go to changefundraising.com and make contact with him. The professionalization of fundraising, I think, is a fantastic and very heartfelt job to be doing, and you seem to be really there and enjoying it. Thanks also to our engineer George, and don't forget, you can join me by emailing yourbusiness@dublincityfm.ie with your comments and suggestions. The podcast of today's show will be available on dublincityfm.ie from tomorrow. Thank you for your company, and please remember to join me, Alec Drew, again next week at the same time, 12:30, right here on 103.2 Dublin City FM, for another edition of You and Your Business.
Fundraising Superstar Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and head over to changefundraising.com to learn more or get in touch with Simon. Or don't, whatever, you're big enough to make your own decisions.
Hello, this is Morgan Freeman. For discounts on Simon's best-selling online fundraising courses, go to www.changefundraising.com/training. And use coupon code PODCAST. Complete them in your own time, wherever you want. Get busy living or get busy buying.